Welcome to the 15th episode of Season 4 of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Tuesday, the 13th of September 2011, and in this episode we're going to talk to Jonathan Naidoo about accessibility, Sarah Shard and Tony Sales about their schools project. We will, of course, cover the latest news events, bit about Ubuntu, command line love, and go over your feedback. I'm Name. With me this week, and I'm Alan, and with me this week is Tony.
Hello.
Laura.
Hello.
And Mark.
Hiya.
There we are.
That's just confusing.
Tony, how are you? What have you been up to?
I'm not too bad, thank you. I became an Ubuntu member.
Really? Oh, yes, you did, didn't you?
Yeah. Last week.
I nearly forgot.
I thought we could eke it out over a series of episodes to describe the tortuous process, but actually it was all over and done in about a fortnight.
It's not tortuous, is it?
No, it's not. That was the point. I was expecting it to be a lot harder than it was, but clearly
it's basically edit a wiki page and then turn up to a meeting.
Yes, of course you have to have been the host of a popular podcast for 4 years.
You have to have done that.
Well, as somebody who's not a developer and who files relatively few bugs, it was all based on my contributions in other realms, such as the podcast and things I do. Mm. But yeah, it was a pretty painless process, really. I had some nice comments and supportive statements.
Yeah. What does it mean now you're a member?
It means I can get an Ubuntu.com email address, and I get all sorts of badges on my Launchpad profile page, and I'm on Planet Ubuntu now, so...
Oh, golly, yes. Yeah. So you can use that. Pimp your stuff.
Pimp my wares on
Don't you get like a clock of invisibility or something?
Yeah, on
IRC. You get a Linux Weekly news subscription if that's much the same.
Yes, that's good as well, which is something you'd have to pay money for otherwise. Mm. But yeah, it's good.
Cool. Laura. How about yourself? What have you been up to?
I'm fine, thank you. I went to a Women in IT event on Wednesday.
Oh, really?
Mm.
Oh, what was that all about?
It was at work. It was
interesting.
Without
wishing to be rude.
Yeah. Well, some of it was really, really interesting in that some of our senior technical women in the lab talking about, well, one of them, she was talking about her career. And it was really nice because she did the same thing as Lorna Jane did at Og Camp, where she didn't just make herself sound amazing. She sort of talked about the bits where she found it more difficult or where things hadn't gone quite right and stuff, which was really good because it makes you feel like, oh, not a superwoman. So.
Right, overcoming adversity.
Exactly. So, that was good. And there were some
public thing?
It was an internal thing, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So, that was interesting.
Excellent. Mark, how about yourself?
I've been listening to sci-fi audiobooks because I realised...
Geek!
Hello, welcome to the Ubuntu UK podcast. I'm really quite terrible at reading books, but I really enjoy them, so I figured audiobooks were an easy way to get the best of both worlds.
Mm.
And where have you been buying them from? The Ubuntu One Music Store?
Audible, cough. Because it was the best... value in the best range.
That's basically Amazon, isn't it?
Yes, it is owned by Amazon. Yeah. And they play on my Android phone, which is what I listen to everything on. So that was basically my main criteria. So at the moment, I'm listening to Dune, which is 21 hours long and very good.
Yeah.
I prefer Terry myself.
When do you get the opportunity to listen to audiobooks? Don't you have to like pay a lot of attention? You can't do it while you're coding.
When my girlfriend's watching CSI mainly.
Ah.
There's a lot of CSI.
There's a lot of CSI.
There is. I once set my PVR. I set it to record all CSI, and within a couple of days, it was full. I was like, oops.
So, Alan, you bailed on us for the last episode.
Yes, I was on holiday.
Okay, so that means you've done nothing whatsoever.
I discovered some very nice pubs in Devon.
Okay.
Which was nice. And I also discovered that the place we are, I tell you what, I did discover is don't get my mother-in-law to book the holiday venue because she doesn't take into account the 3G coverage.
Right.
Oh.
So, there was no 3G while we were on holiday, but there was a hot tub, so that more than made up for it.
Okay. I did see some messages from you where you were standing in the corner of the field with your phone up and the air trying to get a signal.
Actually, I had my laptop standing on a gatepost with a 3G dongle hanging out of it. And I had a torch, and while I'm standing there, I was very grateful that I've got an illuminated keyboard on my laptop. And every so often, I'd hear these little noises at the middle of the night, and it was quite scary. So I shut my laptop and went back to the house.
So extreme.
Yes.
The going out in the dark bit in the first place.
I only went online to download the last episode of the podcast that you guys did when I was there. So I could listen to it in bed on holiday.
That's Alan's excuse for being caught worrying sheep, I think. Downloading a podcast officer. Right. Well, as penance for that, well, we talked to Sarah and Tony from Hereford Lug.
I'll go make the tea, I think.
Okay. All right. You get on with that then.
Okay, we're here with Tony Sales and Sarah Chard from Herefordshire Lug. Hello, guys.
Hi.
Hello.
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 You're going to talk about the open source schools project, which you're launching as part of Software Freedom Day, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right, yeah.
Brilliant. So do you want to start by telling us just a bit about what the open source schools project is?
Okay, well, basically, the Herefordshire Lug decided that for Software Freedom Day this year, they wanted to do something with a focus on education. And we had a little think about it and decided the best thing we could do was actually try to approach schools and get them to look at some open source software. And we started off with quite a small idea and then it rather expanded because Tony decided that he would like to have a go at developing an operating system that would work for schools, which he did with TuxEdu, and we're now at the point where we're going to go into schools and demonstrate TuxEdu and the open source software on it to teachers and children and parents, and hopefully get them to use a lot more open source software.
So what's in TuxEdu?
Well, can I just talk about first of all why I felt the need to create TuxEdu?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Your pronunciation there. TuxEdu, like tuxedo, rather than TuxEdu. The reason I developed it is because even though there are a few distros out there aimed at primary school children, there's Doodoo Linux, there's the Sugar on a Stick project, and there's Edubuntu, they didn't give us enough control over the actual programs which are contained, or the interface, or the size or security of the disk. And what I found with those distros is they're very generic, and they're probably useful for children all over the world, but they don't specifically meet the needs of the English national curriculum and the syllabus. Mm-hmm. By making our own version, we can actually target elements of the national curriculum, which schools have to, by law, meet, and therefore that gives us a little niche. We have programs and combinations of stuff which other distros wouldn't have, and we can obviously tweak that, so it's just right for the school.
So are you specifically targeting it to the UK curriculum?
Initially, yes, because the curriculums across the world are very, very different, and the fact is, if teachers don't have to do something, if it doesn't say somewhere on a form, you have to do this, it's very unlikely they're going to do it.
Hmm.
So by targeting initially the British national curriculum, that's our starting point. If other people think this is suitable, they would want to modify a version for their own educational system.
So what specific alterations have you been able to get into it to tailor it to the UK curriculum?
Well, we've been talking to some of the educational authorities locally. Mark Sanderson, I think, is the guy who's in charge of primary education in Herefordshire. And he's identified a few areas where they've had difficulty finding suitable software for the children to use. So one of them has been finding a suitable animation package that can do stop-motion animation.
Okay.
One has been finding a suitable programming language for them. And one we haven't solved yet is a suitable database application. So we're trying to put in the applications he thinks there's a need for in the schools, which isn't currently being met by their existing software.
Right. So when you were looking at this, the scope of the things you were looking for, were you really just looking at Linux-based open source applications, or did you consider the open source version of applications to run on Windows as well?
In this particular project, I've been focusing on Linux-based applications and distributions, but I think, Sarah, you could explain about the open source software disk, which we've been pushing as well.
Yes, for the past few years, for Software Freedom Day, what the HLUG has done is have a disk that has open source software that runs under Windows, and we give that away, and it's a specific disk that we've created of software that we felt was useful for teachers, for businesses, just for general users. And we give that away at the events that we run on Software Freedom Day and on Document Freedom Day when we run an event as well. But for this schools project, we wanted to do something a lot more specific that we felt teachers would really feel was aimed at them. And the other thing that we've done is produce two different versions of Tuxedu, which means that one version is locked so that children can take it home with them, run it on computers at home without any fear of them getting onto the internet or accessing any programs on the computer and causing problems on the computer.
And that's what Tony meant before about the security of the disk.
I didn't quite catch that, sorry.
Sorry, earlier you said about the security of the disk was one thing you wanted to control.
As Sarah said, we've done two versions. One of them is completely locked down, which means you can't access the hard drive, you can't access the internet. All you can do is use the programs which are provided on the disk and turn the computer off again. So there's no way a child could, for example, accidentally access things either on the local hard drive or on the internet. They can't install it, for example. The other version we've got is actually a fully installable version, and that one, of course, can be installed and they can go on the internet. But initially, we'll be giving out the secure version because we can be confident a teacher or a child can use it and they don't have to have any fear about what they're doing. They're not going to mess up the computer they're using. They're not going to get access to the internet.
Right, so the full version, are you, when you're giving that away, are you designing, is it designed to be run as a live CD initially, or is it designed to be installed permanently?
The installable version is based on Lubuntu, which is the LXD desktop version of Ubuntu. And that is basically the basic Lubuntu package, but with our desktop set up and our programs added on top of it, just under 1 gig in size. It runs perfectly happily as a live CD. But, of course, with that one, you can install it. It has all of the packages in, like a web browser, wireless drivers and stuff like that. The secure version we've built, I did originally try to build it on Ubuntu, and one of the problems I had was Ubuntu now make things so easy for everybody, it was actually quite difficult to completely lock it down and stop people getting access to the internet and loading drivers and things like that. So I built the secure version using Debian LXDE.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so why did you choose schools and educational rather than, say, businesses or third age sector, anything like that?
Well, I think there's two reasons. One of them is that I'm a teacher myself, so I work in education, even though I work with older children. But the main reason is we're constantly trying to get businesses or university students to use open source software, and there's a lot of resistance because basically they've been brainwashed by Microsoft or Mac, and that's the only, they expect everything to work with Windows. So my idea is if we want to convert people to open source software, we have to start with young people, get them familiar with it, or at least so they know it exists, and then as they grow up, they'll be much more open to using it.
So, in terms of actually getting it into the schools, have you found that that sort of the fact that people are already so used to the status quo of Microsoft and Apple that it's actually hard for you to make any headway with this in the schools? Or have you found that it's actually been, there's actually been quite a lot of acceptance and interest in it?
Well, we had, to begin with, thought that we would have a lot of resistance. But what we found was that because we had a bit of a track record with the council and particularly talking to the education department within the council about other events that we'd run, and so we had a basic relationship with them of saying, we're putting on Software Freedom Day, please send this information out to teachers. They had already heard about us.
Yeah, cool.
So when we approached them with this idea of running an open source schools project, they were quite open to it, and actually have proved to be very, very helpful. And having the support of the ICT guys at the council and also of the technicians in the companies that run the school networks has been extremely useful to us. And if anyone else was running a similar project, I would definitely say approach your local council and get them on side, because it's very important for actually getting into the schools, because teachers are so busy and they have so much information coming through to them every day from all kinds of sources that unless you have some kind of official backing, you're going to find it quite hard to get into the schools.
Have you had much contact with the parents?
Not as yet, but we're only just literally starting the project. It launches on Software Freedom Day, and we are hoping to run not only workshops in the schools for the children and the teachers, but we're also hoping to actually arrange some evenings when we can get parents in to talk to them about particularly the lockdown CDs that we're going to be giving to the children.
So how involved is the LUG in general, Herefordshire LUG in general, with this project and these efforts? Are there lots of you able to maintain and help develop this distro, or is it just a small group of you?
There's a core group of us who do most of the work, but we are we're pretty active and we're quite committed to it. So we are lucky that we have such active and willing volunteers, really.
And are they developers or system administrators, or are there people helping with documentation?
We've completely mixed skills. There are some of us who are like Tony, who can develop and who are at ease with that side of it. And then there are others who are good at the documentation side, and others who have already had experience of working in schools or in the education sector. So we are very much a cross-section.
Cool. You mentioned earlier some of the needs which you were trying to write Tuxedu to fulfil. What applications have you actually got on there which are there to meet those needs?
Well, initially, when I first picked applications, I just threw everything on I could find which seemed appropriate for the age group.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did a bit of testing amongst ourselves and got feedback. It was also a question of size on the disc. So I started off with things like Child's Play, G-Compress, yeah, and PySci-Cache. Now, they're three, if you like, suites of applications which contain lots of mini-games within them. So I started off with those because for very young children, reception age, year one and two, they're ideal for getting people to use the mouse, to use the keyboard. They've got simple word games, simple games with sounds, matching patterns and things like that. So I started off that as a base. I then added the three famous Tux programs, which is Tux Maths, Tux Typing, and the third one, which is Tux Paint. So that covers numeracy, literacy, and graphics, which those are three excellent programs. The other main programs I've added in, there's a few interesting ones like Numpty Physics, which I think is a great little program.
Yeah, I've been playing that recently.
It's basically you have to draw things freehand with the mouse, and then the laws of physics take control, and the objects you've created will fall to the earth or roll around.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
And I've also, I am stuck on level 10 though, so if you know a way around that, please let me know. The other side of that is that I've also installed quite a lot of the KDE educational applications, mm-hmm, like K Geography, I think there's K Typing, all of the ones that start with a K basically. They're actually quite, even though I'm not particularly fond of the KDE desktop, those applications are quite well written and there's a lot of documentation for them. So we've given a good selection of educational programs from ages about 2 till 10. Obviously, we will be making a DVD version, and we may be making some scripts that allow people to install more packages afterwards. And that'll be the next stage after our initial pilot study, is to start expanding the programs we include based on what teachers and children say to us, rather than saying, this is what we're going to give you. Started off with a basic selection, they can then tell us what they want more of and what they want less of.
Cool. There's obviously a lot of work that goes into managing a distro. Are you able to look at getting a commercial footing for this so that you could do it as an ongoing business, perhaps either through sponsorship or pre-installed applications, something like that?
Well, I think at this stage that's very premature to talk about that. I mean, at the moment I'm making the distro myself, which I've spent most of the summer holidays doing it in my spare time. And I've done the same for Vinex now for 3 years. I think once you start talking about money and making a profit or earning a living out of it, the whole nature of the enterprise changes. And for me, one of the important points is this is a community effort, mm-hmm, not doing it for personal gain. And I think that in a way, the project then stays pure in that sense. And I think between us, there's probably half a dozen of us who will be able to help with lots of parts of the with the distribution manufacturing process. And that's probably enough for us to do it.
Excellent. So where can people find out more if they would like to get involved?
Well, I think the first place to start would be the Tuxedo website. It's very simple. There's basically one page at the moment and a link to the downloads page. And they can find that at http tuxedu.org.uk. Tuxedu is spelled T-U-X-E-D-U.
Cool. We'll put a link in the show notes so that they can make sure they find it.
And obviously they can find out about Software Freedom Day and the Herefordshire Lug at herefordshire.lug.org.uk.
Brilliant. Okay, right. Thanks very much for coming on the show.
Thanks very much.
Cheers. Thanks.
It's time for a command line, love, and this time one has been sent in by somebody called Alan Pope.
Yes.
And he's going to read it all out to us in its entirety now.
No, I'm not.
Good.
It's very long. It's probably the longest one we've had so far, Mrs.
Okay, what does it do?
So I was bored one day, and I thought, I wonder if I can get a random package from the repository and find, you know, something that I've never seen before, some application that I've never tried, because people tell me there's thousands of packages in the repository.
Yep.
And there's loads that obviously I've never seen. And I thought, well, I don't want to just look at random packages because I might find libraries or...
I was going to say lots of libpango dev 2.3.
Yeah, so I don't want anything that starts with lib, and I don't want anything that ends in dev, probably.
Okay.
So I constructed this rather shonky command line, and all it does is grep through the package list that you already have on your machine, on your Ubuntu machine, and cuts out a few of the things that you don't want, and then... shuffles it and randomly picks one, and it does an apt cache show to show you the details about the package, so you get the short description and what it depends on, so you can see, oh god, that depends on a bazillion other packages, so I won't install that, or just read the description and decide whether you want to play with it or not.
And what delights have you discovered using this fantastic thing?
Yeah, not much.
Okay.
I did find myself like running it repeatedly. I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll install one randomly and then force myself to play with that and, you know, learn about this new package, or maybe file a bug if it doesn't work the way I expected it to.
Right.
And I found myself going up arrow, press enter, seeing something and going, oh no, I don't want that. And then up arrow, no. I found myself being a lot more selective than I thought I would be.
Is it like playing the chance game in Argos?
I don't know what the chance game in Argos is.
Tony flies this.
It's just where you write down any number and go and buy it.
Yeah, well, you go into Argos, tap it into the machine. If it's got, if it's in stock, you know, you've got to go and buy that item. He's randomly enter.
He's never yet hit a real number.
No, fortunately.
So I tweeted this, and someone suggested you could do, you know, some kind of Russian roulette by a good Russian roulette where you install the package without actually reading the documentation, change from apt-cache show to just apt-get install whatever random package it comes up with. And I thought, yeah, that might be quite fun. And then someone else came up with a Russian roulette of removing random packages.
the real we'll Russian roulette.
Put one package where the installer just runs rmrf slash.
Oh, no, I wouldn't do that. No. And that's command line hate. That's another segment we're thinking of. Yeah, so yeah, that was it, really.
That's the end of the command line, love, then.
So last episode, someone suggested that we have an accessibility expert on to talk about some of the issues that developers should keep in mind when they're developing applications to be accessible. Jonathan Nadau volunteered to talk to us as he's experienced with both free software and in using free software accessibility. And Jonathan's on the line now. Hello, Jonathan.
Hey guys, thanks for having me on. It's an honor to be on the show.
Oh, that satellite delay there causes a bit of a panic thinking you weren't there. Oh dear.
Hiya. So you've been doing stuff with GNOME, I think, just generally in Linux and accessibility. And I was wondering how long you've actually been using free software and free software with accessibility.
It's going on about 4 years now.
Okay.
How did you get started?
Well, I was using a proprietary operating system with proprietary screen reader, and I heard about Ubuntu maybe like in 05 or so, but I didn't actually visit it until around 07 when Gutsy Given came out. I went to the Ubuntu... website, and I was reading about it, and it said I had a built-in screen reader, and I thought that was fascinating. So I downloaded it, and everything worked right out of the box the minute I downloaded it, and I started using the Orca screen reader. And from that on, I started learning about free software, and the whole idea of it fascinated me. And from there on out, I have completely stopped using any proprietary software and only use free software now.
So before you used Ubuntu, you were using proprietary software. Were you using similar kind of screen readers and tools on I guess, Windows?
Windows doesn't really have a screen reader. They claim that there is one, but they should be really ashamed of what it is, and they shouldn't even call it a screen reader. It's unfortunate that Windows leaves room for these other companies to come in and make proprietary solutions, because for someone to get a screen reader that actually works on their computer running Windows, you're looking at basically anywhere from $900 to $1,500 for one license.
Wow. And
yeah.
Oh, my God, that's unbelievable. And so, obviously, it's very attractive to have an operating system that comes with this stuff out of the box. Obviously, this is very expensive software on Windows. How does it really compare? Is the stuff on Ubuntu any good, you know, for someone who actually uses this stuff?
Well, I would have to say, at first, with Gutsy given, it was, you could use it, but, you know, there was definitely a difference between, you know, the proprietary solution and Orca at that time, the screen reader is Orca. There's definitely a difference at that time, but now it's quite comparable. There's maybe a slight difference, but for me, it you know, I can do everything I need to do with the free solution.
Could you explain briefly what a screen reader is for people who haven't come across them before and what it's like to use one?
Sure. Orca is very tied into the GNOME desktop, so almost any distribution running GNOME, you can start Orca. A large majority have Orca installed by default, so to start it, you would just hit the Alt F2 to bring up the run box. You would type in Orca, and Orca would start, and then you would just go through a quick setup process. It might take like a minute, and you would log out and log back in, and you'd have a screen reader. So what I would do on a GNOME desktop, I would hit Alt F1, and that would bring me to the menu where places and system and the applications part of the menu is, and I can arrow through that and, you know, select what I'm looking for. If I want to go into the home folder, I can click on that and browse through the home folder. If I want to write a document, I can open up, you know, LibreOffice or OpenOffice at the time and type out a document. Or you can, instead of going to the menu again, you can open up that run box with Alt F2 and just type in the name of the program and hit enter, and it'll just open the program from there.
And it just reads out any text that it comes across.
Yeah, I prefer doing it that way. It's just, you know, so much quicker just to type it in than to have to maneuver through the menu by arrow, you know, down, down, right, down. It's just a lot quicker to start it from the text.
Okay, what sort of things make a screen reader experience work well and work badly in terms of software?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Sorry. When you're using a screen reader, are there things about software that can make it very irritating or difficult to use?
As far as accessibility, I know the GNOME has like the on-screen keyboard. There's also magnification, which is built into Orca, but I know quite a few low-vision users that actually use the Compiz instead, because the magnification on that is, I wouldn't say considerably better, but it's a little more flexible than the magnification built into Orca. I know there's some text-to-speech engines, but those are being worked on currently, and they're quite hard to actually get implemented. It takes quite a long time for that to really, like, get working, like the Dragon naturally speaking. That takes a long time for stuff like that to work, so that's still in the works, and hopefully that's coming along.
And I understand you run your own business doing selling systems, is that right?
Yeah, well, I was doing that. I stopped not like shortly ago. I stopped doing that, but I was building computers with Ubuntu pre-installed on them, and I was calling them blind optimized, where I would get the machine ready for a blind user to use out of the box.
And is that difficult for you to do? Because obviously, from my perspective, I stick a CD in and you know, boot the thing up and go through the installer, and you're installing clean on new systems for someone else. Are there problems actually going through the installer before you even get to the desktop?
That is kind of part of the hurdle to get over. So what I would do is my wife would help me install it, and once it was installed, I would just go in and set everything up, get set up Orca and everything. So that way, when the blind user bought the computer, all they would have to do is turn it on, and the computer would boot up, talking right away, and then be able to use the computer right out of the box.
Right.
So you do quite specific work. Is it promoting accessibility in open source, or do you actually get involved with developing?
I don't do any developing. I call myself a free software advocate of accessibility and free software. I've been doing whatever I can to be involved in various communities to help out accessibility and get involved and report bugs. And I've done, the latest project I actually worked on with Ruben Rodriguez from the Triskel distribution. And hopefully he'll be pushing this change to Ubuntu, which would be great. I was working with him, and he worked with the Ubiquiti installer. And what we managed to do is if a person takes a live CD and drops it into their tray and they boot off of it, if you do not touch it when it goes to the first menu where you would pick your language and stuff, if you let it sit there for 30 seconds, the installer will automatically boot into a live session with the Orca screen reader running by default. So what's great is a blind person and a sighted person could benefit from this because when you guys put in the disk, you'll see the language menu and you'll just click on it. And the minute you do that, you won't even realize that it has an accessible installer. But if a blind person puts it in, they'll just let the CD sit there and it will go through, it'll skip through the picking your language and boot right into a live session with the Orca screen reader running, and then they can install it on their own without any sighted help at all.
And once you've set one of these systems up for someone, is there like a prescribed set of applications that are, like you say, blind optimized, or is it basically any GNOME application should just work okay because Orca's built for GNOME?
Well, you have the best chance of out of the box, like anything written in GTK. You have a much better chance at kind of working out of the box because Orca works really well with GTK. Right now, anything written in Qt at this moment isn't really accessible, but the Qt framework is being worked on, and I think when they release the version 5, and there's also another piece of program being worked on called the Accessibility Protocol. I don't remember. It's like 4 or 5 long letter acronym, but it's basically like an accessibility layer, and they're making a Qt version of that, which once that's implemented, Orca will then be able to see applications written in Qt, and as long as the proper protocol has been followed with writing the applications, then those should become accessible also.
So I guess one of the big issues for a lot of people, if you're looking mostly at GTK apps as working well and Qt not so good on GNOME, would be apps like Skype, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, Skype will work because there's actually a pigeon plugin for Skype.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So if you wanted to use it, yeah, you can, it ties into Skype, so you can see like all your contacts and you can make calls and you can chat and everything with the pigeon plugin for Skype, so that works. So that, if you look hard enough, there's always a way around something. Most applications really, when you're using the GUI, there's really commands going on in the background from the command line. So if you know a lot of the switches that you need to type in from the command line, you could probably use most programs from the command line anyways if you are that determined to use a particular program.
How do open source applications fare on the web in terms of, say, using a site that's based on Drupal or WordPress? Do you find that they're, how easy are they to use compared to other sort of maybe just odd websites or websites based on other proprietary CMS systems and things like that?
It works really well. I haven't really run into a WordPress site or a Drupal site yet that I haven't really been able to access, everything on the screen. I've even built a handful of WordPress and Drupal sites myself, and I can even manage the, the admin page for all of those, and I can see everything even on those to create pages and put in text and write blog posts and stuff. So both of those frameworks are extremely accessible from what I can tell.
Cool.
We've had a question from Anton in the #Ubuntu-UK-podcast IRC channel asking if there's an introduction to getting started anywhere. He'd like to try some screen readers and things with one of his colleagues at work.
Well, there's one project I would look at, which would be Vinix, which is an Ubuntu-based distro, but it's specifically built for blind and visually impaired users. And I think the website is vinix-project.org. And if you go there and you download any of the distros, really, but the latest is 3.2, which is based off of Natty. And if they downloaded that and burned the ISO, and then if they put the disk in, it'll just automatically boot into a live session with the Orca screen reader running. And they could either, you know, try out the desktop from the live session, or they could even go to the installer and install it themselves. You know, a blind person, again, could install themselves without any sighted help.
Oh, what have they made changes to the installer then, or done some work to make the installer more easy so they don't have to, you know, get their sighted partner or a friend to help them do the install?
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure what Vinix did. I know they have build scripts that you can look at, and I believe what Vinix does is Tony Sales, the project leader, what he'll do is he'll install, he's sighted, and he'll install the distro with the accessible installer that's built into Ubuntu, and after he installs it, he then uses his build scripts and remasters this and basically creates a new ISO image of installing the distro with the accessible installer. And when he does that, when he creates the new ISO, it automatically boots into the live session with the Orca screen reader running, which is slightly different than what I was saying that Ruben Rodriguez did from Triskel. He actually changed some of the code in the Ubiquiti installer. I think he did it in about 20 lines where, again, like I said, if you just let it sit at the first screen and then it just automatically boots into the Orca screen reader.
Awesome.
So Vinix, just to confirm, is V-I-N-U-X, is that correct?
V-I-N-U-X.
Yeah, actually, we spoke to Tony Sales earlier in the program. We were interviewing them about another subject.
Tony's a great guy. I've spoken with him quite a bit.
Ah, cool. We're doing quite well on these matching up of interview thing going on. another quick question from SuperNGR in the IRC channel, asking how a visually impaired installer setup screen would allow the user to choose their language. If it sets up a screen reader automatically, can they actually then choose different languages as well?
Well, I know with both Tony's Vinix and the Triskel, they'll get when they boot into the live session, it's automatically in English. But when you click on the installer, the first option is to change the language. And I know on Triskel, if you do change the language, the Orca screen reader will change to that language. I'm not sure about Vinix. I obviously haven't had a need to do that, but Ruben speaks Spanish and he tested it out and it does work on Triskel.
It's worth pointing out that there's a new project in Ubuntu for each loco team to create a customized ISO image, and the idea is that it boots into your default language by default. So you could take a customized version of that, and that makes things even easier if it boots directly into your first language.
Yeah, I would assume if you did do that, and when they start Orca, it would just automatically speak in that language. Orca, I think it must almost work in every language that Ubuntu does offer. When you go through the setup, there's like literally, 25 to 30 languages you can choose.
Oh, within Orca, so Orca has its own language setting separate from whatever you've got the desktop set to.
Yeah, well, when you set it up, the first question, I don't remember the first question to ask because I just do it by on autopilot now, but there's a section when it asks, what language do you want? And it starts going through them, one, English UK, two, English US, and then three, German, four, French. And it goes through, a whole bunch of, like I said, 25 to 30 languages. It does, Vietnamese and Mandarin and Greek and all kinds of languages.
Awesome.
Cool. So if anybody's got any other questions, can they bug you on Identica?
Yeah, I'm Frostbite on Identica. If you go to Identica / Frostbite, they'll find me.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for talking to us. That was really interesting. And we'll hopefully...
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Speak to you soon. Cheers.
Bye.
Bye.
And now it's time for the news. A tablet version of Firefox has been released for Android 3.0 Honeycomb. The new version features the signature Awesome Bar and adjusts the UI depending on the device's orientation to make best use of space.
Welcome to about 2 years ago, probably.
Awesome.
Really?
I'm confused by this. Yeah. Tablet, I mean, everybody uses Chrome or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, yet another mobile web browser. Google has axed a number of projects to concentrate resources on higher impact products. Projects given the boot include Google Desktop and Google Pack, showing a tightening focus on browser-based offerings.
There is a very good line on the Google Pack website saying that the popularity of downloaded software is declining.
Really?
Yes. Please use Gmail. Please use Gmail.
It's declined even further now, isn't it?
Actually, it's funny. The Google Desktop and Google Pack, I only ever see on other people's computers that I end up having to fix for some reason. I see their toolbars and stuff.
I don't think I've ever seen it either.
No.
A guide to running. You finished that quicker than I was expecting. A guide to running OnLive, the cloud-based gaming platform on Wine, has been published. The service uses the online servers to run the games and stream the display to the client, giving the potential to bring modern high-end games to Linux.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
I mean, technically, they're not running on Linux. Isn't this, in any way, shape, or form.
Isn't this the equivalent of running them on a Windows box and VNCing in?
Pretty much. Right. But, well, it kind of. But what they do is, I think they stream. They encode whatever's coming out of the game, the screen, as a movie, effectively, and they stream the video. So all your PC is doing is playing a video, HD video, and you're sending the keyboard events and mouse events back the other way. And it, when you look at the video, it actually looks really impressive. A game like Batman Arkham Asylum, which isn't available on Linux, and they're playing it on an Ubuntu desktop. Okay, it's using a third-party proprietary service, but then it's a proprietary game, so, you know.
Yeah.
Double freedom-hating.
All your games are belong to us.
Yes.
A Freedom of Information request into the public sector IT spending has shown that the government departments continued to spend large amounts of money on proprietary software, despite previous promises to create a level playing field for open source.
Fancy that.
Yeah, I think the Freedom of Information request was made by the BBC.
Yes,
It was.
Yes.
Well done. No one seems surprised by this.
Nobody is very surprised.
No. Even one of the things was they were trying to do I don't know if it was one department or the whole government was trying to build a database of all the software assets they had, and they put out to tender to invited sort of open source companies in.
Was it an access database?
Well, it wasn't, but they invited all these companies to tender for it. They had about a week to prepare it. They came to this meeting, and then somebody who didn't come to the meeting got the contract anyway.
And they were proprietary software.
And they were proprietary, I think, yeah. So, hey-ho. Mm.
So Cliff Richard's Winter Fuel worries have been relieved by a European extension of copyright for music recordings to 70 years.
Yeah, all that campaigning worked really well, didn't it? When we got the thing thrown out a couple of years ago, it sort of snuck through the back door without a vote in the Parliament.
Mm.
And now,
because apparently Cliff Richard is on the poverty line and needs the money for this recordings for some work that he did 30 or 40 years ago.
That's right. Everybody else has to save their pension while they're working.
Yes.
But not musicians.
No, these creative types, they're allowed to get paid over and over and over again for years they did the work.
Not even necessarily creative types.
Not even
a session
songs.
Musician, you know, or someone.
Yeah.
Or...
My mum would like it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, me. Several servers owned by Linux Foundation, including kernel.org, have been compromised. The Foundation has advised all users to change passwords and SSH keys while the servers affected are being rebuilt.
Okay, so these are quite big compromises, aren't they? They've been offline for several days.
Yeah. And it's affected a few websites, and I don't think they've fully released the details of what's happened yet.
Okay. Well, we'll have to wait to see how long it takes to come back online. They don't think any of the kernel source code or whatever has been affected, and it's now available via GitHub. So
Linus posted an announcement, you know, in the fact that everything is open and I can use other services, so he did. put the code up somewhere else.
Absolutely. EditShare have revealed further details of plans for their professional video editing suite Lightworks, which they plan to release to Linux this year and open source in 2012.
Yeah, some quite famous films have been made using Lightworks.
The King's Speech, I think, was one of the ones recently. I mean, it's a professional video editing application, and although it's not open source, the pricing looks like it's going to be reasonable for support if you actually want to pay for commercial support. It's not going to be very expensive.
Yeah, I mean, there's been some complaints that, you know, they're taking a long time over this. They're kind of dragging it out a bit. And even at the end of the day, the open source bit won't actually get you very far because you still need all the codecs, which you will have to pay for or pay a license fee for.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, that's the way of the world. And, you know,
it'll be interesting to have, and I'm interested to look forward to giving it a go when it's open source. Mm.
Ben Goldacre has launched Nerdy Day Trips, a website for crowdsourcing geeky points of interest around the world that might be good for a visit.
Ooh, are there any around here?
There's one on the Isle of Wight, which is a disused rocket base.
We've been there.
War, yeah. Wow. And there's a few things sort of around the New Forest and things as well.
Yeah, I was quite impressed that I was looking around near home and the first thing I clicked was the Bubble Factory in Oswaldwistle in Accrington. It's like, it's on the map!
By home you mean the north.
Yeah.
Right.
Sorry, can you say those words again?
The
what in where?
The Bubble Factory.
The Bubble Factory.
In Oswaldwistle.
That's a real place.
I don't really care what it is. I just wanted you to say it again.
It's a real place with a name long enough that it has to have an apostrophe on the road signs.
Oh, bless.
Yeah. And that's all of the news.
And we have some events. The Ubuntu UK Happy Hour is happening around the UK.
This is Alan Bell's great plan to basically get drunk in as many pubs as possible, I think. Yes.
Yeah, I think, there's a few reasons for it. One was to make sure that people all around the country can get involved, because a lot of the events are always in the London and South East area. The plan is to people to nominate a pub or venue and choose a time and a date, and people go there on that particular date for an hour or more. And it sounds like fun, you know, go to a pub. I can't see anything wrong with that.
And Alan Bell buys all the drinks, I seem to remember.
Yes, that's what I heard he was saying. he said something along those lines.
Yeah, definitely.
17th of September, it's Software Freedom Day. Hang on, that's soon, isn't it?
This Saturday.
This Saturday is Software Freedom Day. And Hereford and the All Saints Cafe from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And there are other events all around the world, apparently.
Yep. Join in with those. Similarly, Barcamp Blackpool is on the 15th of October. They've done a second release of tickets. There are still about 12 left, so you stand a chance of getting one now. But they also need projectors and screens, so if you're able to provide any of those, you're going along to a Barcamp Blackpool, get in touch with them.
And there's a LibreOffice conference on the 13th to the 15th of October in Paris. Sounds rather good.
Yeah.
Especially if you like LibreOffice.
Well...
And
or Paris.
It crashed on me a lot in the week.
Oh dear.
Ooh, go and complain. And the FOSDEM dates have been announced. It's happening on the 4th and 5th of February 2012.
Are you going to go this year?
Maybe. Next year? Maybe.
Well, this time. Yeah.
Maybe. You're thinking
about
it.
Yeah, I've missed 4 years.
Just the beer you miss, really.
Well, yeah, no, and the companionship with my podcasting buddies.
Yeah, we can do that here. It's a lot cheaper to go for a curry in Southampton than it is to go for a curry in Belgium.
True.
But yeah, maybe go this year. Cool. And that's the end of the events. Right, it's now time for the bit about Ubuntu. And the first thing we're going to talk about is the... 2 year terms of 5 out of 6 of the Ubuntu Technical Board members, which are finishing at the end of the month. So there's an election process going on.
Yes.
About that.
Well, you've pretty much explained it.
What's the technical board do?
The technical board make decisions on the technical direction of Ubuntu, like they choose programs that are included on the CD, maybe, or help direct the project in a technical manner, compared to the like community council, which do community level stuff. The technical board might, you know, decide, for example, on whether to go and synchronize with Debian stable or testing or unstable or whatever. And there's a few members who are expiring on that team.
So people like Scott James Remnant,
Colin Watson, Case Cook. I think Mark Shuttleworth is always on the technical board. He's got a special place.
Well, it's his ball, isn't it?
Yes, his magic box of shiny coins.
Yeah.
Yes.
So there's a nomination period that runs up till today. in fact.
So yeah,
it ran till 3 o'clock this afternoon. So hopefully, if you're an Ubuntu developer, you'll get the chance to actually vote in that soon.
Yes.
Good luck.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah,
I think I'm not sure I know the process for that.
Actually. I think Ubuntu developers are allowed to vote on the technical board.
Oh, okay.
As far as I understand it, not normal Ubuntu members like me.
Like you and me.
I'm just a pleb.
Yeah.
And after our interview with Matt Revell on the last show, Canonical are going to hire a usability and communications specialist for Launchpad. Not as a direct
contact. I was going to say, because our interview was so great.
Also bad. They need a new communication specialist.
Matt mentioned they were looking to hire this role, and now it's available for review online.
And notice they've got a software engineer up for grabs as well. Not literally. Okay. You know, a job.
Where do I sign up?
Is it Graham Binns? Can we grab him?
And John O'Bacon has blogged responding to criticism of the new menus in 11.10.
Yes. Yeah, he basically wrote a blog post saying, hey, look, the menus that disappear and then appear when you put your mouse near them, and they look great. And lots of people kind of disagreed with him.
Yeah. So he pointed out that if you open every toolbar in Word, it looks really bad. Yeah. Which I think that's took it to an extreme, but yeah.
It does, but that's Word, I think Word 2003 he's got the screenshot from. And Word has changed its UI for the ribbon interface to kind of enhance the discoverability of its menu items. The idea you can flick around a lot more quickly between those menus. But it's also that time of the year where... Sorry, Alan.
No, go on.
I was to say, it's also that time of the year where Jono pimps it's his birthday coming up and asks people to buy him presents.
Is it?
Yeah. So watch out for that. I'm sure that'll be in a blog post near you soon.
This blog post isn't going to get him anything.
No, it's not. It really isn't.
I found it an interesting read, and it's, you know, it's, as he says at the top, he's not a usability person. It's just one guy's opinion about how he thinks that the new way the menus work in Ubuntu 11.10 is quite good. I personally don't agree with him, and I don't particularly like the idea of having menus that are hidden by default. I'm willing to try it.
It's all about the balance between efficient screen real estate use and the discoverability of having things on the screen so people can see them and easily know to click on them. And find out what happens.
Yeah.
Depends if your screen's that small that you can't give up space to the menus, I suppose. And I don't think that's the case with any of the computers I use.
Well, it's not just the fact that you're giving up space and there's, you know, space you might want to use for, you know, it's one extra or two extra lines in a terminal or, you know, one extra line of text in a browser. It's something sat on the screen that doesn't need to be there for the most of the time for most people is a waste of space.
I suppose so.
And that's the whole direction with Unity anyway, isn't it? Hide everything until you need it.
Throw your mouse towards the thing you need and then it appears. But I agree with the people who've made comments that say one of the problems with it is you can't go straight for a particular menu item. Like, where the menu is, you know, file, edit, view, history, bookmarks. If I want to go to the bookmarks menu, I can fire my mouse straight at bookmarks. Whereas what most people find with a hidden menu is they throw their mouse somewhere near the corner and then have to track horizontally to get to the one they actually want. And that's not efficient.
I guess the slightly annoying thing is that what gets put there in place of the menus is the name of the application you've currently got open.
Now, the title bar or something.
Yeah, sometimes it's the file name, but I don't think it always is. So it seems like not very much to replace the menus with. But.
Yeah, I mean, it's determined by the application as to what they put in their title bar, isn't it? Like Internet Explorer sponsored by Internet,
And Scott James Remnant has written a lengthy proposal for the new Ubuntu release process.
Yes. It's good.
It's very long.
Well, I think I understand it.
It's kind of not surprising given he now works for Google on Chrome that have a development cycle that looks very much like the one he proposes.
Yeah, he certainly identifies some of the things that I have thought are problematic with the Ubuntu release cycle as it stands at the moment. The 6-month release cycle effectively only giving about 13 weeks work for developers who are full-time on the project. Once you take the freezes and the merges and tests and all this other thing into account, and 2 weeks to recover from UDS, apparently. you only get that sort of a short period of time. It's not a very efficient release process. So I can totally identify with the reasons he's put this proposal forward. And there is a counter-proposal from, I think, George Castro. I might be wrong in
name.
No,
it was MPT.
MPT, was it? Okay. He basically said he should go the other way and only do two-year releases, which is almost the Debian model of releases. Mm. kind of. They try to, they aim for that at least. So Scott James Remnant is proposing a monthly release of
monthly
Ubuntu.
Release. Almost so, sort of rolling release.
Yeah, but you could you can choose which you subscribe to. As a user, you could say, I only want the 2-year one and I'll stick on that.
Yeah.
Or you could say, well, I want to keep the monthlies and you'll get new packages, you know, quite regularly. Or you could go further and say, I want to be on the beta cycle or the alphas and get stuff daily or weekly. Yeah, get a weekly update.
That is a lot like Debian, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Yeah, fancy that.
Yeah.
And that was one of the reasons I moved to Ubuntu, was the fact that I didn't like having to run Debian Unstable to get the latest stuff and it breaking a lot all the time.
Yeah, me too, actually, yeah. That's
so,
all.
So 6 months is quite a nice compromise, really.
And now that's all in the bit about Ubuntu.
Yeah, I like it.
And Jay Forrest, it's time for the feedback.
Come on, tighten up, everyone.
Okay, so Jeff Forrest emailed us about his new Linux News podcast, and we're going to put a link in the show notes in case you're interested in taking a listen. And it's a twice weekly podcast that
aims to be accurate by making sure we have the facts straight. We only use reliable and respected sources, and when we report rumour, we make that clear.
And
aims to be fair and not state personal opinion.
So you see, we don't feel at all threatened by this.
we rarely have our facts straight.
And we certainly state personal opinion. So if you want something to contrast with us, you know, you go listen to that.
Yeah, I presume they're not just getting their stories from the Register or whatever.
I don't know.
Who would do that?
Not that we do, but, you know, it would be a reason for it not to be very accurate, if you know what I mean. Right, and finally, the Wing Commander has sent us a message from his travels.
Hello? 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 Oh, bugger. Hello? Ah, that's better. Wing Commander, Sir Arthur Curmudgeon, back on the line, speaking to you wirelessly from my very own loco, the Orient Express Railway train, don't you know? Marvellous thing, these smartphones. Not quite my definition of smart. It's a bit plasticky for my taste. I've put a tweed cover on mine. Evidently, this thing runs a sort of Linux as well. So, open source credentials tick, jocks away, and off we go. I'm taking a little trip, you see. We just turned left at France on the way to Istanbul. I've been telling my fellow passengers all about Agatha Christie, whose house I stayed at when I was a child. And they've been discussing the ideal train-based murder they'd like to commit. Apparently, they've all met some loud, obnoxious English tourist on the train and can't wait to get rid of him. I haven't seen him yet, so I'm hanging about the dining car where he's supposed to be loitering. Anyway, I'd better get on before we go into another tunnel. The point I wanted to make about your last program is
oh dear.
Just in case you're wondering, that word he said at the beginning was debugger.
Yes.
Nice.
Right, okay, I'm not going to bleep that twice.
So, yeah.
Do you think that's it? Do you think it's the end of the Wing Commander?
Or do you think we can get Poirot on the case?
I wonder whether we've heard the final message from him. Unless he starts leaving us messages from beyond the grave.
The ghost of the Wing Commander. Ooh, that sounds like a nightmare.
Yeah,
song.
I'm sure there could be some sound effects in there that we could get Creative Commons, I don't doubt.
Absolutely. Maybe he'll put in an appearance in our Christmas episode. You never know.
Ooh. Oh, jingle jangle.
The ghost
train.
Of Wing Commander's past.
Yeah. And that, rather surprisingly, is the end of your feedback.
And it's all for the episode. Thank you for listening. You can find out how to get in touch with us on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org, including voicemail numbers, Twitter feeds, Facebook, IRC, all that kind of stuff. Let us know what you think of the show and give us your thoughts about Ubuntu and the community around it. Join us on Tuesday, the 27th of September, for our next live episode.
Yeah, awesome. I'd really like to receive some voicemail. We don't get much voicemail.
No, we get the odd random weird one from some bloke travelling on a train. But yeah. We, yeah.
That may not happen anymore.
Yeah. If you're listening, yeah. Other than him. Leave us a voicemail each.
Yeah, phone us up.
And we'll play
we'll fill the whole show.
Yeah, and then we can just sit here eating cake.
Yes.
Anyway, see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.